Let's talk next about an addiction. It's an addiction to a game you play on your computer or smartphone.
People who play Candy Crush or Angry Birds can find it hard to stop, and that is by design.
Game makers use behavioral scientists to figure out how to keep us playing and how to keep us spending. Here's Stacey Vanek Smith from NPR's Planet Money team.
It's not a natural human instinct to fling birds at pigs or move jelly beans around a little screen. No, game designers have to create that urge.
Games are full of things that try and compel us to action.
Nir Eyal used to be a game consultant, and he's tried every trick.
From the way the games are designed to help us start playing the game, to the way they keep us coming back to the game, to how they involve our friends in the game, all of these things have underpinnings in consumer psychology.
Eyal wrote a book called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. He says you can make almost anything addictive. So I tried to think of the dullest thing possible. My breakfast, toast.
Toast.
Toast, yeah.
Okay.
Could a video game based on dry bread really keep people playing? I called up a bunch of consultants and game designers about this. People like Roger Dickey. He created Mafia Wars, one of the most successful video games of all time. He said, if you really want to do toast, you need something that will grab people immediately.
If the toast looks cute and there's a kind of fun mechanic, maybe something twitchy where you have to tap the toast at just the right time for it to come out of the toaster or whatever, I could see something like that working.
But goofy sounds and fast-moving butter knives will only get you so far. To keep people playing, you need to provide lots and lots of little challenges. The more challenges, the better. I ran my game by consultant Ramin Shokrazad. The basic challenge, I was thinking, could be like to make the toast but not to burn it, to get it perfectly toasted.
Well, sure, but let's spice it up by saying we have a range of different cooking devices. We have a range of different bread sizes.
Okay.
We might have time pressure added. We might have a number of people who are demanding toast, and they all want it cooked a different way.
And maybe different stuff on it, too. Butter, jam, Nutella.
Exactly. So now we might have three different, totally different orders going on simultaneously. We have time pressure, and we have to try to juggle this.
And, of course, the better you do, the more you move up in levels, from short order cook to Toastmaster General. Shokrazad works at wargaming.net. His official title is game economist, but he throws around a lot of biology terms. Those little challenges, he says they stimulate dopamine in your brain. That time pressure stimulates adrenaline. So far, my fantasy toast game seems pretty exciting. You could waste hours slicing and buttering, but there's one piece missing. How does someone make money off of a toast game? All the consultants I talked to said it's pretty easy. Just wait until a player is in a groove, overcoming challenges, and then put a big, fat barrier in front of them. Run out of time, run out of lives, run out of delicious strawberry jam.
And you need a little bit more. Well, you'll pay to get it. Once we break through that initial barrier, you know, once you're the kind of person who's willing to buy an item in a game, which isn't everybody, then you'll do it again.
In the business, this is called fun pain. You love the butter, we take away the butter, you'll pay to get it back. Roger Dickey says a smart game will give people choices. They can pay with money, or they can pay by inviting their friends. Facebook, Twitter. And if your friends are playing a game, that means you'll play it even longer. So, now that all of the addictive elements are in place for the toast game, will I hear this coming out of every smartphone? My expert said, probably not. Lots of game designers have studied human behavior, but very few games are big hits.
It's like fashion. It's like producing a blockbuster movie title.
Sometimes you're Angry Birds. Most of the time, you're toast. Stacey Vanek Smith, NPR News.
Oops, I messed up. That's Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella walking back what he said yesterday about women and pay raises. At a conference on women and computing, he was asked what advice he'd give women who are uncomfortable asking for a raise. Here's some of what Nadella said.
It's not really about asking for the raise, but knowing and having faith that the system will actually give you the right raises as you go along. And that, I think, might be one of the additional superpowers that, quite frankly, women who don't ask for a raise have. Because that's good karma. It'll come back. because somebody's going to know that's the kind of person that I want to trust. That's the kind of person that I want to really give more responsibility to. And in the long-term efficiency, things catch up.
Well, those comments ignited a firestorm of criticism, and Nadella later admitted in a statement, "I answered that question completely wrong. Was inarticulate," he tweeted. "Our industry must close gender pay gap, so a raise is not needed because of a bias." The question that got Nadella in trouble was posed on stage by the president of Harvey Mudd College, mathematician and computer scientist Maria Clave, and she joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be there.
And when you heard Satya Nadella advise women to rely on faith and karma, their superpower, as he put it, if they want to raise, did you think right away, wow, he has really stepped in it?
Well, you know, as you probably know, in the middle of an interview, you're not necessarily, or at least I'm not necessarily, processing all of the possible implications of what was said.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
So I was just busy thinking about what I was going to say next. But in this case, I just said, that's one of the few things I'm going to have to disagree with you on. And one of the reasons I said that is I personally have difficulty negotiating a raise or negotiating a salary.
And you mentioned some specific examples from very far into your own career. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, when I accepted the job of Dean of Engineering at Princeton, I accepted it without negotiating anything. And this is just irresponsible for a mature human being to do this. Hmm. But I did that. And eventually, when Shirley Tillman, who was president, who hired me, made me an offer, it was the sort of the median salary for deans of engineering. And it didn't even occur to me that I was at Princeton, which is one of the wealthiest and highest and paid high salaries.
They could have done better.
They could have done better, and I'm sure they would have done better, but I didn't say anything. And then next, when I was offered the position of president at Harvey Mudd College, the offer was quite a bit lower than what I'd expected. And instead of saying, you know, I appreciate that offer, but I really think a more appropriate offer, given my level of experience and all of these kinds of things, would be something higher and suggest something, instead of doing that which I coach people to do all the time, I just took it.
You didn't do it yourself.
I didn't do it myself. So having been through this experience, I will never make that mistake again.
Well, what do you think it is? I mean, there's been so much discussion about this in women and asking for what they want, and especially in the world of tech. What do you think is behind that reluctance to ask for raises?
You know, I think it's a cultural thing. Young women are raised to be polite, to serve others. And, you know, I'm perfectly fine going after a salary raise for somebody who works for me. I mean, I'm really aggressive about that. But somehow it just seems awkward to do it for yourself. And, of course, it's the kind of thing that if you practice it, you know, I was advising the women, you should role play asking for a raise. But we have to understand that we're living in a society that has, where we all have implicit bias.
Well, how common do you think his attitude, Satya Nadella's attitude is toward women and raises? How common is that in the world of tech?
So I don't think it's common at all. And Satya doesn't have that opinion for women. He has it for everyone. Now, he has learned a lot in the last 24 hours, and I think he has that opinion for no one now. But it definitely wasn't something about women shouldn't ask. It was about a cultural belief, which, you know, fits with where he comes from in South India, that you shouldn't ask for things, you shouldn't demand things.
But he did say that women seem to have an additional, as he put it, superpower in this regard.
Well, he had this whole theme of superpowers, and I think one of the things he was saying is some of the things that women get criticized for are actually strengths. Now, I don't think this is a strength for women, which is why I disagreed with him. I actually think it's something that in our current world, the people who ask do better. And, you know, it's actually one of the things I talk to my students about, that asking for a raise is asking for help. It's asking for recognition. And the willingness to ask is a very important skill that we should all learn.
Along with being the president of Harvey Mudd College, you're also a Microsoft director. And I wonder if comments from the CEO of Microsoft, Satya Nadella, like we heard, put you in an uncomfortable spot.
I feel badly for Microsoft getting the bad press because I don't believe they deserve it. On the other hand, I'm really proud to be a director of Microsoft, and I'm very proud to be part of the board that hired Satya Nadella because I believe he's a spectacular leader. because of the person he is. And I'm sorry he said that. I really am. For everybody. I mean, I'm sorry for him. I'm sorry for Microsoft. I'm sorry for me because I feel guilty about it. But this whole furor that has happened over the last 24 hours, we're going to end up in a better place. And I just hope we get there sooner rather than later.
I want to go back just a second to when we were talking about, you know, your impression when you heard him say what he said on stage. I did notice in watching the video of the conference that when you said, "I disagree," there was applause in that room. I mean, I wonder if you could tell from the reaction of people that people were really taken aback by what they had heard Satya Nadella say about karma and having faith in the system.
Yeah, you know, they were taken aback because he had been so obviously an advocate for women in technology throughout the 45 minutes of the interview that preceded that response. And so people were just sort of like, where did that come from? And when I disagreed with him, because I do disagree with him, I mean, he now agrees with me on that point. He has apologized. I would just love for us all to embrace everyone who wants to help with this and make progress on the problem rather than saying terrible things about somebody who said something stupid.
It's interesting. You say he's apologized. I've read his statement. I've looked at his Twitter feed. I don't see an actual apology in there. He does say he got it wrong. He learned a lesson. He didn't say, "I'm sorry for what I said."
Oh, well, I'm sure he could say, "I'm sorry for what I said." I know he's sorry for what he said. I read that message to all of the employees as an apology and as a commitment to understanding that he had things to learn and he needed to learn more. And he's going to take that learning and move forward.
Maria Clave is the president of Harvey Mudd College. She's also a Microsoft director. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
The holiday season is approaching, a time for Santa and sales and fears of credit card breaches. Cyber thieves have already stolen millions of card numbers this year. Kmart and Dairy Queen are among the latest victims. Charles Lane from member station WSHU explains that shoppers are heading into the heavy spending season with no new safeguards in place.
When you hear about a data breach, Brian Sarton is one of the guys who goes in to investigate.
I've seen my own personal information in those lots of stolen data many, 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 many times.
Sarton heads a team of forensic computer techs for Verizon. Good guy hackers, basically. For a while, he and his deskmate had a running joke.
How frequently in our cases we would find one of his credit cards. And I remember back-to-back, it was like 2 out of 3 cases. And there was a third, and we're like, "It's not here." And he's kind of laughing. And then all of a sudden, we found his wife's.
Sarton says data breaches happen all the time. In fact, only about a third of them are ever made public, which surprised many shoppers here in Midtown Manhattan, like Alexandra Goodell.
It's upsetting. It gets me angry. I work really hard, and I don't want to go out of my way to cancel my card and to nail down what happened.
One of the main reasons why U.S. credit card numbers are stolen so often has to do with how we process them after the swipe. Again, Brian Sarton.
That transaction in a text format of some kind is sent to a server there at the store that all of the cash registers speak to.
Your credit card number then flies through the internet to the merchant's main national computer, then to the processor, then to the bank, and then back again.
It returns in 0.06 seconds with a yes or no.
And you walk out of the store while the transaction continues to ricochet across the country. And that's technology from the 1970s.
What we need to do in the U.S. is completely replace an architecture that has been deployed over the course of the last 40 years. That's how long magstripe cards have been in the market.
Jason Oxman heads the Electronic Transaction Association. He says the magnetic stripe worked fine until the 90s. Then PCs came along that could counterfeit hundreds of credit cards. Because the U.S. had a really strong telecom network, retailers started verifying a card's authenticity online. In places where the internet wasn't so great, they adopted what are called chip cards or smart cards.
So that's one reason that we haven't used the chip cards. We haven't needed to because our online system of authorization has been a replacement for that offline chip.
But by this time next year, you will likely be using the new chip cards. What slowed them down is the chicken or the egg conundrum. Banks didn't want to issue the chip cards if retailers didn't have the readers. And retailers weren't going to buy them if banks weren't issuing the cards.
There are more than 10,000 financial institutions that issue credit cards and debit cards in the U.S. There are 8 million merchants that accept credit and debit cards in the U.S.
But the new chip cards are only expected to cut about 60% of the fraud, which frustrates merchants. Mallory Duncan is general counsel at the National Retail Federation. He fears the credit card hacks will continue because at the core, the system's backbone is still the same. 16-digit account numbers flying across the internet.
Unfortunately, all we're going to get in the near future is the not-quite-so-smart card. The problem is that this product itself is fundamentally flawed. You cannot secure a house of straw.
Duncan says retailers want something more. They're looking to what's called tokenization, where instead of your account number flying through the internet, there's a one-time-only randomly generated token of your account number. This is what Google Wallet and Apple Pay use.
All of those potentially are much more secure for consumers than would be partially secure chip cards.
Tokenization is out there now, but not yet for credit cards. Because they require significant system upgrades for both retailers and the banks, it's that same chicken and the egg problem. Who spends the money first? For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane.
Today, tech, money, and the millennial generation. People from their late teens into their early 30s are establishing new patterns of spending, and especially of donating money. And as you might expect, that involves the internet. NPR's Elise Hu explores how young donors are changing charity as we know it.
Scott Harrison's story starts in New York's hottest nightclubs, promoting the proverbial models and bottles.
At 28 years old, I realized my legacy was going to be just that. You know, here lies a guy that got people wasted.
So he changed his story. Harrison volunteered to spend the next 2 years in West Africa. What he found when he first got to Liberia was a drinking water crisis. He watched seven-year-olds drink regularly from chocolate-colored swamps.
Water I wouldn't let my dog drink.
Most childhood diseases in the developing nations he visited could be traced to unsafe drinking water, so everything changed for Harrison. But when he came back and wanted to start raising money for clean water, his friends were wary.
They all said, I don't trust charities. I don't give. I believe charities are just these black holes. And yeah, I don't even know how much of my money would actually go to help the people I'm trying to help.
So Harrison's one cause became two. He started Charity Water to help dig wells to bring clean drinking water to the nearly 800 million people without access to it around the globe. But he also wanted to set an example.
We are also really trying to reinvent charity, reinvent the way people think about giving, the way that they give.
Demographic change is a huge reason for rethinking this. Around 80 million Americans are considered part of the millennial generation, and the norms for how millennials spend their cash aren't the same as their parents.
Our culture is changing pretty dramatically. That sense of, I need to give out of obligation, I don't know that that's going to be around 20 years from now.
That's Baltimore-based Amy Webb. She helps forecast digital trends for nonprofit and for-profit companies. One piece of advice she gives on appealing to younger donors, don't even say donate, because younger donors want to feel more invested in a cause.
You know, it may seem something simple. It's just semantics, you know, donation versus investment. But I think to a millennial who's grown up in a very different world, one that's much more participatory because of the digital tools that we have, to them, they want to feel like they're making an investment, that they are investing not just their capital, but they're investing emotionally.
And there's the tech part. She says any philanthropy without a smart digital platform, not just for donations, but for empowering a community of givers, will be left behind. Which brings us back to Charity Water. Designers spend a lot of time finding ways to save their donors' time. Scott Harrison.
I think there are a lot of people that are more than willing to be generous with $20, $30, and $50, but their time is actually worth something. And the thought of pulling out their credit card and fighting through a 3- or 4-page form is just too much.
Denny McFadden is a user experience designer for the group.
Anywhere we can trim the fat, it helps.
But Charity Water's big success with young donors is giving them a chance to call on their own real-life social networks for help. Harrison.
Ideas that the millennials have embraced was this idea we kind of stumbled into, where we asked people to give up their birthday for clean water. So I went around asking everyone I knew to donate $32 for my 32nd birthday.
Soon, tech CEOs were raising tens of thousands of dollars per campaign by giving up their birthdays for water. This spring, NFL safety Cam Chancellor joined in. And the generation that comes after millennials, the children today, are getting into it too.
We had seven-year-olds in Austin, Texas, go door-to-door asking for $7 donations, and 16-year-olds in Indiana asking for $16 donations. And everybody could get behind the simple idea that my birthday could help other people live happier, healthier lives.
The group's focus on social networks and simple design means 4 million more people in 22 countries now have access to clean drinking water. But you don't have to take our word for it. Charity Water's latest tech improvement is putting remote sensors on wells so donors can see just how much water flows from what they helped build.
We think this is just going to be game-changing.
Changing the old charity playbooks by choosing new technologies. Elise Hu, NPR News.
Finally in tech, a message. An instant message. For many millennials who grew up in the age of AOL Instant Messenger, or AIM, the only thing more embarrassing than the amount of time you spent using it was your screen name. Well, we want to hear them. The more embarrassing, the better. And to kick things off, we've asked a few people for their mortifying monikers.
My name is Tavi Gavinson. I'm a writer, actress, and editor-in-chief of Rookie. My IM name was pretty normal. It was Tavi Toons, which is like a nickname that my friends had for me. But the real gem was I was very into Neopets, where you have these little digital pets, and myself and a couple boys from my synagogue, we were like, we'll be so much more powerful if we join forces. So our name was Jews Rule 3.
My name is Rembert Brown, and I am a staff writer at Grantland.com. So my most embarrassing AIM or AIM screen name was Rem Shady. If we go back in a time capsule, this is junior high, elementary school, when every boy at that time especially was like obsessed with Eminem. And Eminem's nickname was Slim Shady, and I was like, Slim Shady, Rem Shady, boom. It was like, it was very early wordplay for me.
My name is Megan Gans, and I'm a writer for Modern Family. Well, my most embarrassing screen name was my first one. It was Irony 601. 601 was for my birthday, and Irony was because I thought I was the only person in the world who really understood that concept at age 11. And then an even more embarrassing screen name I had shortly after that was Dawson 23, which was not after Dawson's Creek, but actually after Jack Dawson from Titanic. You can't ask me to put anything in stone at that age. It's just going to be embarrassing.
That was Modern Family writer Megan Gans, Grantland writer Rembert Brown, and Rookie Mag founder Tavi Gevinson. Well, now it's your turn. Send us your old screen names with a quick note explaining why you made that terrible, terrible choice. Tweet us at NPRATC, post to our All Things Considered Facebook page, or write an old-fashioned email to alltech@npr.org. Put the words screen name in the subject title. Just don't try to instant message us. We deleted ours a long time ago. And we'll read a few of the screen names on air in the coming weeks.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep with birthday greetings to Anna Storr, who was born in 1900. She is 114 years old today. But don't tell the people at Facebook, because Ms. Storr tried to sign up for a Facebook account. She could not do it. The social media site was not designed to handle a triple-digit age or such an early birth date, so she finally had to lie about her age, chafing off the years until she was merely 99. It's Morning Edition.